Hi folks. Welcome back to Season 2 of the Troubles Podcast. This season we'll be focusing on the different people and incidents that happened during the 30-year period known as the Troubles. For any new listeners, welcome, and I hope you enjoy the podcast. The episodes are all put out in a non-sequential order, so you can listen to them in any order whatsoever. Though if you want a general primer, I'd recommend episode 6 of the first season. I'd like to again thank my Patreons for their support since launching this podcast. Their financial support, feedback, and comments have been essential to the ongoing continuation of this podcast. Patreon members can request episodes and also get early access to episodes. I'll also do video updates from time to time. If you want to sign up, you can do so at patreon.com/the-troubles-podcast. Also, I had some requests for people who want to donate on a once-off basis. You can do that by buying me a virtual coffee over at buymeacoffee.com/troublespodcast. If you want to support the podcast in other ways, please rate, review, or just tell your friends. It all helps. Thank you. Before we get into the show, I'm going to play a short promo for the crime podcast Canadian True Crime. It's a fantastic independently produced podcast narrated by Christy, and definitely one to check out if you're a true crime fan. I'll let Christy tell the rest.
Hi, I'm Christy, an Australian who's called Canada home for more than a decade, and I'm also the host and producer of Canadian True Crime. Join me for an immersive deep dive into some of the most thought-provoking and often heartbreaking true crime cases in Canada. Using facts curated from court documents and news archives, I take you through each story from beginning to end, with a look at the way the media covered the crime and the impact it had on the community. You can find Canadian True Crime on Apple Podcasts, your favourite podcast app, or visit canadiantruecrime.ca.
Now, back to the podcast. It was late in the evening on the 24th of October 1990, when 65-year-old James McAvoy was dragged from his bed by masked men. McAvoy was sick with cancer at the time, and was in a weakened state. He was driven to the town of Omead in the Republic of Ireland, where he was strapped into a van filled with explosives and ordered to drive to an army checkpoint. James was one of the three human bombs that would be forced to do the bidding of the IRA that night. For some, there would be no escaping the van. This is the Troubles Podcast, a podcast which explores the violence and bloodshed that occurred in Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and Great Britain, as multiple sides and organisations waged a conflict over the status of Northern Ireland. A human bomb, also known as a proxy bomb, is defined as a vehicle-borne delivery of an explosive with the distinct feature that the driver has been coerced into participation. It was a tactic that was used by the IRA in the early 70s, then again in 1990. The concept of a proxy bomb is relatively new, and its first use in modern history was by the IRA in 1973. It was also used by Ulster Loyalists in 1974. For the most part, the attacks that were carried out during this period were prevented, and the bombs were defused. This episode will focus on the most lethal attack, which took place on October 24, 1990. Proxy bombs, which are also known as human bombs, were also used by FARC rebels in Colombia after some members of the IRA travelled there and allegedly helped train them. Human bombs differ from suicide bombing, in which the bomber is doing so of their own free will. A person is forced to become a proxy bomb under duress. Some would have their family held at gunpoint, or be followed as they drive the bomb car at gunpoint, or even be unaware and believe that they will be set free after driving the bomb to a checkpoint. It is a lethal and graphic method of waging war. Back to Northern Ireland. As the British Army dramatically increased their searches and checkpoints, it became more and more difficult for the IRA to carry out regular bomb attacks. The IRA went through many different variations of their bomb making. When they assassinated Lord Mountbatten in 1974, they had a solid understanding of remote detonated bombs. They also could booby trap their bombs with a mercury tilt switch so that they would explode if touched or disturbed by anyone. They also had moderate success with homemade mortar bombs. The IRA believed that the proxy bomb campaign would show the British Army that they had changed tactics, and in the words of a former IRA bomber, they wanted to shake the Brits out of their complacency. They also wanted to get revenge on the security forces after IRA member Desi Grew and his brother, Seamus, were killed by undercover British soldiers earlier that month. The British Army had also made some improvements throughout the Troubles, and by the 90s they were getting better at stopping IRA bombing attacks. Army checkpoints had been altered in such a way so that they were immune to timer-controlled vehicle bombs. British intelligence had also developed radio-free zones, where radio frequencies were jammed, preventing the IRA from detonating remote bombs. Eamon Collins explained in his book, Killing Rage, quote, "There was a problem with radio-controlled bombs, problems with the signals penetrating the Army's protective radio wave shield, which surrounded every police station, Army base, and military vehicle, and blocked signals between sophisticated radio devices. Once an IRA radio bomb had failed to detonate, the Army could retrieve the weapon and identify the radio code on the receiver, thus neutralizing all bombs using the same signal. It could take a year to find a new sign." For the most part, the IRA avoided specifically targeting civilians. Their car bombs were usually targeting economic centres of towns or British soldiers. Despite this, civilians accounted for around 650 deaths of the 1,800 people that the IRA would kill during their 30-year campaign. For the IRA, it was important to keep the civilians on their side throughout the Troubles. Eamon Collins continues, quote, "It was the community upon whose support the IRA depended. Without the community, we were irrelevant. We carried the guns and planted the bombs, but the community fed us, hid us, opened their homes to us, turned a blind eye to our operations, even though that community support had dwindled over the years. Part of me wanted the community to say, we need you as you need us." The proxy bomb attack of 1990 really shocked the people of Northern Ireland. The three people that the IRA chose to become human bombs were just civilians. One occasionally fixed RUC officers' cars, while the other worked as a kitchen hand in a British Army base. They were civilians in every sense of the word, and their main concern was feeding their families. It was the 24th of October 1990 when the most lethal attack was set in motion. The plan was to take three civilians, strap them into three separate vans filled with explosives, and have them drive to British security checkpoints, where the bombs would detonate, killing the driver and anyone in the vicinity. The bombs were all scheduled to explode at the same time, across three different checkpoints in Northern Ireland, so that the alarm could not be raised. Patrick, or Patsy Gillespie, was the first person who had become a human bomb. He was a 42-year-old Catholic man who worked as a kitchen hand at a British Army base, which was enough for the IRA to see him as a target. Some sources say that he was repeatedly warned by the IRA to quit his job, but he refused, most likely due to the large levels of unemployment and poverty in the area. This wasn't the first time that Gillespie was used in a proxy bomb attack. 4 years earlier, in 1986, he had been forced to drive a car with a bomb in it to an army checkpoint. That bomb didn't go off, but back then the IRA would have allowed him time to escape. But this time the bomb was designed to kill him as well as the targets. His wife described what happened on the night when the IRA knocked at their door.
They took Patsy away at midnight. They let him into the living room to say goodbye to us. And I was sitting in the armchair with Jennifer and my knee. And he put his arms around us and says, "Don't worry, girl, everything will be all right. I'll be home soon."
Patsy was kidnapped and chained to the driver's seat of a van loaded with £1,000 worth of explosives. He was then forced to drive to the Cosquín checkpoint outside the city of Derry, with members of the IRA following closely behind in a car, before turning off just before arriving at the checkpoint. He reached the checkpoint around 3:55 a.m. in the morning, and as the van slowed to a stop, Patsy attempted to open the door and alert the soldiers. The explosives in the van could be detonated remotely, but were also rigged to go off if the interior light of the car was switched on, which occurs if the door is opened. Patsy did not know this, and once he opened the door, the bomb went off.
Province. One massive bomb went off in Londonderry, killing at least five people.
The bomb blew a huge crater in the road and caused extensive damage to the checkpoint. Six other people were injured in the blast, and all are said to be in a serious condition at the city's Altnagelvin Hospital. Local people were treated there for shock.
We all panicked. with the shock, and the children were all crying and screaming with the shock. Oh, it was terrible.
Very post flat. There's pieces of concrete right up about 180 metres up the road onto the estate. Blew off that checkpoint.
It should be noted that there are conflicting sources regarding what actually set this bomb off, as some sources mention that the bomb was on a timer which exploded as he arrived to the checkpoint. Either way, the bomb was detonated and caused a huge amount of damage. Patsy and five British soldiers were killed in the attack. They were Stephen Beckham, Vincent Scott, David Sweeney, Paul Worrell, and Stephen Burrows. There probably would have been a higher death toll, but the soldiers were sleeping in a thick-walled, mortar-proof bunker, which had recently been built. Initially, there was confusion as to whether Patsy had been killed in the attack, as there was very little of his body left to identify. His wife described the aftermath.
I said to the detectives when we went to the mortuary at Elton and Galvin, are we going to identify the body now? And he said, coffin's closed, Captain. And that's when I thought something not right here. Patsy was identified by a piece of flesh which was found attached to a part of a graze-up of the cardigan he was wearing when they took him away.
At his funeral, Bishop Daly said that the IRA and their supporters were, quote, a complete contradiction of Christianity. They may say they are followers of Christ. Some of them may even still engage in the hypocrisy of coming to church, but their lives and their works proclaim clearly that they follow Satan. The second victim of the proxy bomb campaign that night was 65-year-old James McAvoy. He was a Catholic civilian and was targeted by the IRA because he allowed RUC officers to fill up petrol at his filling station and occasionally serviced their vehicles. Just a quick note here, that a lot of this account comes from the book Double Agent, written by a person using the pseudonym Kevin Fulton. Fulton claims that he was high up in the ranks of the IRA, while actually working as a double agent for the British Army. The book is a fascinating account of the inner workings of the IRA, but it is important to remember that the entire book is written in his own words, and many of the claims made are impossible to verify. Fulton claims that he was born a Catholic in Northern Ireland, and that he joined the British Army at a young age. He then began working as a double agent for them and began a mission to infiltrate the IRA. It took a good few years, and eventually he joined and rose up the ranks. His story, and the story of other double agents, is fascinating, and I will be devoting a full episode to it in the future. Fulton claims that he was part of a squad that kidnapped James McAvoy. He described in his book how an IRA team stole a car and drove over to the house of McAvoy in the town of Newry. The garage operated as a petrol station, small shop, and also had a showroom with cars for sale. The family home was part of the building itself. The men approached the house and knocked on the door, which was answered by a teenager. They pushed past the teen and made their way into the sitting room of the house, where there was a woman in her 50s and some children. Upon seeing the men, the woman pleaded with the IRA and offered them all the cars in her showroom. James was upstairs in bed. He was gravely ill with cancer and in a weakened state. The IRA took him from the house, assuring the woman and children that they'd be bringing him back in a few hours. He was blindfolded and brought to the town of Omead, across the border in the Republic of Ireland. Another group of men stayed with the family to ensure that the alarm wasn't raised. Fulton and the IRA members were then told to drive to a safe house and waited there throughout the night. By this stage, the IRA knew that there were informers and leaks in their ranks. So when operations like this were being carried out, the men were separated into groups, and very few of them knew exactly the full extent of what was being carried out that night. They just knew their small role in the overall scheme. Then, so that no one could alert the authorities if there was a leak, all of them spent the night in a safe house together until after the bombings had occurred. Like Patsy, James was strapped into a van which was filled with explosives and ordered to drive to the accommodation block of a checkpoint in Armagh. An IRA car followed the van but turned off just before the checkpoint. Bolton described in his book how one of the kidnappers felt sorry for James. He said, quote, "He couldn't stand the sight of the sick old man wheezing and spluttering, driving to certain death. Johnny told him to pull up the checkpoint, unwind the window, and exit the van that way. He told him to run like fuck and don't look back." James reached the checkpoint and stopped the van and immediately jumped out the window and tried to run away. In his book, Bolton claims that a soldier manning the checkpoint then started shouting at him to get back in the van and move it. James kept shouting that there was a bomb in the van, but the soldier grabbed him and started dragging him towards the van to move it. At this exact moment, the bomb detonated, killing the soldier and injuring 14 others. It should be noted that there is another variation of what happened this night. Mia Bloom and John Horgan claim that the soldier was trying to drag McAvoy out of his vehicle to safety and the bomb detonated shortly afterwards. The soldier who died was a Northern Irish Catholic, Cyril J. Smith. McAvoy survived the bombing, suffering only a broken leg, but died 7 months later from cancer. According to his wife, he never got over what happened that night in October. 42-year-old Jerry Kelly was the third person kidnapped that night. He lived with his wife and child in the town of Oma and was targeted because he was a mechanic who worked at a local British Army facility. He was told to drive to the Lionelli Army camp in a caravan. There were 200 pounds of explosives in the caravan with him, and he was strapped into the seat, with IRA gunmen following behind. Jerry then described what happened next. Quote, "Don't try anything stupid, as we will have a rifle trained on you. They were driving behind me. I drove through the gate and shouted, 'Bomb! Bomb!' and managed to struggle free. Everything was going through my head that this was my last moment." Kelly approached the barracks and got out of the caravan and ran. He was lucky that night because the bomb failed to go off, as a result of a faulty timer. In total, 7 people were killed after this operation, and 36 were injured. All 3 of the attacks were carried out within 6 minutes of each other. In the wake of the attacks, the IRA released a statement saying, quote, "This morning's military operation again devastates the myth of containment. Until the British government end their futile war in Ireland, attacks such as this morning's will continue." The IRA initially saw this operation as a success. They also believed that the people they chose to become human bombs made them legitimate targets. Martin McGuinness, a high-profile figure in the IRA and member of the Sinn Féin party, spoke to a Dutch news crew shortly after the attack.
"The people who have been targeted by the IRA are themselves making a conscious political decision to take the British side in the conflict.
So you see this as a justifiable punishment for human bombs?"
"Well, the IRA see it as a just. I mean, it's not my job. It's not my responsibility to justify what the IRA does. I understand the reasons why it happened."
In Northern Ireland, there was a very immediate response to the attacks. The Catholic public, of which the IRA relied on, were shocked and disgusted. There was a massive public revulsion, which was so fierce that the IRA soon abandoned the tactic altogether. The proxy bomb campaign was a complete PR disaster for the IRA. One Catholic resident said of the attacks, "Everybody was in tears. I've never seen a community so moved. There wasn't a dry eye. Mrs. Thatcher ought to send in the SAS and clear them out once and for all. I don't mind saying it. Today I'm ashamed to be Irish." Peter Brook, who was the British Cabinet Secretary in charge of Northern Ireland, said of the attacks, quote, "They have sunk to new levels of depravity by using people whose families have been held hostage as human bombs. It's hard to believe anything more evil than tying a man into his car laden with explosives and then forcing him to drive to where the bomb was detonated. Horrible as these murders have been, they have not advanced the cause of those who perpetrated them by a single millimetre. Indeed, they have set it back even further." Finally, SDLP member John Hume said of the attacks, "The anger at this particular atrocity is far deeper than anything I've seen in this city since 1972, when a local youth who joined the army was shot visiting his family. The one word that is on everybody's lips is the word coward. Let me repeat it. I hope you're listening, you cowards. Using a human being in the way you did." Even other Republicans were disgusted by the attacks, with some claiming that it made the IRA look like, and I quote, "those fanatics in the Middle East." There is one theory that these attacks were designed to hurt the hawks in the IRA. The hawks were those who believed in the armed struggle. After this attack, the case for the Doves strengthened. When I say Doves, I'm referring to those who believe in reunification via a political and peaceful means in the IRA. In total, 6 people were arrested for the proxy bombings. 2 of those arrested were Anthony Heaney and William McGuinness, who was the brother of Martin McGuinness. They were eventually sentenced to 6 months in prison for failing to account for their movements. The 2 later appealed this conviction, saying that their obligation to account for their movements contradicted their right to silence. The case began in the Irish courts and then moved up to the European courts in the year 2000, where they were awarded around £24,000 and had their convictions overturned. In the aftermath of this attack, there were several more human proxies planned, but they were soon abandoned due to the level of public outrage. There were a few which went ahead, but the bombs failed to detonate. In 1991, the IRA decided to try the tactic again, but this time they would use a Protestant victim instead of a Catholic. On February 3rd, the IRA forced Tommy Wallace to drive a 500-pound bomb from Tobermore to the Ulster Defence Regiment Army Centre on Station Street, Mahara Felt. His wife was being held hostage in another car. Wallace escaped and shouted a warning to the soldiers before the bomb exploded, causing structural damage to 50 houses nearby. Wallace had been targeted because he worked for the construction company Henry Brothers, who did construction work for the British security forces. In response to these attacks, the loyalist paramilitary group, the Ulster Freedom Fighters, copied the strategy a few years later. A Catholic cab driver was given a bomb and forced at gunpoint to walk it into a Catholic church. It was then detonated by radio control, killing him and 2 others. According to a US senator who was present at the scene, a crowd of Protestants who had gathered outside the church shouted, "Yabba dabba doo, any Fenian will do." The proxy bomb campaign arrived late in the period known as the Troubles, and was uniformly condemned by all sides. In a way, this tactic demonstrated the power of public opinion and how it affected the IRA. They needed to have the public on their side, and the wave of revulsion caused by these attacks caused the complete opposite to occur. That's it for this episode. See you next time.